for individuals interested in the medical field. Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast, where doctors from around the world discuss groundbreaking work in the medical industry. Because in an ever-changing world, healthcare is constant.
Welcome to the second episode of the Doc Talk. Our esteemed speaker today is the reputed Dr. Ranjana Danu. Dr. Ranjana Danu is a surgeon specialized in laparoscopic and robotic surgery, currently practicing at prominent hospitals in Mumbai, including Hinduja Healthcare, Asian Heart Hospital, Breach Candy Hospital, HN Reliance Hospital, and Surya Childcare. One of the most renowned minimal access surgeons in the country, she has been a consultant for the past 23 years. By 1996, she was appointed as honorary consultant in gynecology and obstetrics by most major corporate hospitals in Mumbai. In fact, she is the only obstetrician in the country who has the credit having delivered the grandchildren of the most prominent politicians across party lines, as well as having attended to obstetric needs of family of prominent business houses, bureaucrats, celebrities, and corporates. While continuing to establish herself as a spectacular surgeon, she has trained and certified in robotic surgery in the year 2013 to sharpen her proficiency and offer an advanced level of service to patients. In addition to her professionalism, the humane touch and empathetic demeanor of Dr. Ranjana Danu has always been a highlight of her reciprocation with patients across all strata of society. Widely regarded as one of the top three gynecologists in Mumbai, Dr. Ranjana Danu has gone out of her way to be part of this podcast. It is an honor to have you on this episode of the Doc Talk, ma'am, and I cannot express my gratitude enough. While we start this introduction, my first question to you, and I think it's a very important one, would be about PCOD or polycystic ovary disease, which is very, very common globally and especially in India. Ma'am, what would you say are the symptoms of PCOD and when should women get checked for the same?
So before I start off with the question, thank you for the kind introduction, wishing everybody a very good morning. We need to brighten up everybody's spirits, giving them a little bit of a health talk in this pandemic. So quickly now, talking about PCOD, let me tell you that PCOD is seen in one out of four girls today. And it's not something to be taken by surprise. We were seeing this over the years, but there was no awareness. If you remember, we used to see as children that somebody's grandmother grew a little beard or hair on the chin around the menopause. And we used to say, oh, around her old age, my grandmother developed a beard. What was that? That was all PCOD. Okay. So PCOD basically is a condition wherein there is a problem with ovulation. You know that a girl ideally ovulates on the 14th day when her egg gets recruited on the second day of the cycle. And the thumb rule is once she has ovulated, she has to bleed in the next 15 days. So that makes her cycle a proper 28 or a 30-day cycle. When the periods get irregular and you backtrack, you see that there is a problem with ovulation where the egg is not getting released. So these eggs start to get trapped in the ovary cycle over cycle. And they harbor the male hormones. And that is how girls start to manifest with facial hair, acne, a little bit of abnormal hair on the breast, below the belly button, and very severe cases, hirsutism. It's a myth that every patient of PCOD may have fertility issues. Certainly not. We have very few, say about 4 to 5%, who actually need gross treatment. Otherwise, most of the PCOs manifest to us in different age groups. So, there could be a girl coming to me at the age of 13 with her mother, where the mother complains saying she's been having continuous periods for the last 5 to 6 weeks. Or there could be a teenager coming to me at 16 to 17 years with severe acne. Or there could be a patient in the reproductive age group saying, well, I have a problem getting pregnant. Or there could be somebody who has delivered kids but says that I have abnormal heavy bleeding. So understand that once you have PCOD, once you've been documented as a case of PCOD, PCOD is there to stay. Any amount of alternate therapies that will be offered to you who promise you saying they will take away PCOD can never happen. So you have to learn to live with the disease. All right?
Understood. So what exactly would be the course of treatment then? I wouldn't say something that could cure it because there's no cure for it.
So it's all symptomatic. It's all symptomatic. So Basically, there is a direct correlation between weight and the manifestations of PCOD. So you have to optimize on your weight. As a thumb rule, PCOD would be associated with thyroid or prolactin excess. And if there is a thyroid excess or prolactin excess, that causes water retention and weight gain. And the more the weight gain, more severe the PCO.
Understood.
So in simple words, there's got to be diet, lifestyle modulation, exercise, rectification of cycles, wherein we correct the cycles, depending on how her bleeding pattern would be, if it's heavy bleeding or if it is something which is irregular, wherein she's getting her periods every 60 days, we need to regularize them. Now, regularization could be whether a girl needs fertility, so whether she wants to plan fertility induction or whether she wants just regular cycles. So if she just wants regular cycles, we have the fourth generation pills, which are extremely good. And we can give it to them year after year, but only after an annual pill evaluation, wherein a patient has to undergo certain tests to see that she's fit to take the pill. Even though these pills are available around the counter, you need to have one particular physician who you could go and ask whether you are fit to take the pill, and only then go ahead and take the contraceptive pill. Should you want fertility, then you can go ahead and take the fertility inducing pills in order to get pregnant. So also in PCOD, because there's a state of hyperinsulinemia, you need an anti-diabetic tablet. So in 2000, in the year 2000, this was a breakthrough which said that Glycomet or metformin is the non-surgical treatment for PCOD. Okay. So giving these drugs definitely helps, like a lock and key mechanism in reducing the severity of PCOD, extremely safe, but needs to be taken under medical supervision.
Got it. Thank you so much for that.
And year after year, you have to keep checking yourself for PCO even after the menopause, because there could be a possibility of having a thickened uterine lining. So you just need to be careful. There's a lot of information which can kind of psych a patient with PCOD, saying, oh, you could be at a risk of cancers. Not really. Please don't get overly enthusiastic about reading on Google. So there are always ways in which you can tackle this. And the baseline or the hallmark of treatment of PCOD is to see that you keep your weight in check, keep your hormones in check, and you're fine.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, ma'am. And I'm sure most teenagers undergo PCOD, and similarly, like most medical students, like our listeners are mostly medical students. They're mostly teenagers and are constantly being told to get the cervical cancer HPV vaccine. So at what age would you recommend taking it, and why is it so important?
Okay. So now, the human papilloma virus is a virus that gets introduced into the vaginal tract at the first sexual debut. Each sexual partner is going to introduce a new strain of HPV into the body. This HPV has an affinity for the cervix, which is the mouth of the uterus, which is dipping into the vagina. These HPV strains harbor at the cervix and cause slow changes, which eventually in the years to come can develop into precancerous and then cervical cancer. So in order to prevent this, we say we recommend the HPV vaccine to all girls between 9 to 45 years. There are two brands of the HPV vaccine which are available, Gardasil and Cervarix. So Gardasil is given at a dose of at 0, 2 and 6 months. So the day 0 is the day that she takes it, the primary dose, then after 2 months and after 6 months. There are a lot of times when there are mothers who come to me saying, oh, my daughter is going to uni, so can I just give her the vaccine in 0, 15 days and 3 months?
Yeah.
No, your body needs to develop that immunity. There are girls who take the first vaccine then get pregnant. So what do they do after they deliver? They take the second and the third dose in lactation. So it's not, unlike the rubella vaccine, it's not going to be causing any harm to the baby if you get pregnant after the HPV vaccine. But I would definitely recommend it to all girls between 9 and 45 years. I don't know, this is a myth wherein so many girls come to me saying, oh, I'm 25 or I'm 27, and they say it's not going to be effective on me. Not really. I think you should go ahead and take the cervical cancer vaccine. Extremely safe. No problem, just take it as a jab on the arm. The other vaccine available is Cervarix, but the time schedule for that is between 0, 1, and 6 months.
Okay.
So if you defer it beyond 6 months or defer it beyond 1 month, is fine, but not earlier for sure.
Understood. So, is there any other prophylaxis for cervical cancer, like any other way to prevent it apart from the vaccine itself?
My darling, cervical cancer basically is not genetically related. Understand that breasts, ovaries, and the uterine lining all have a genetic predisposition or a familial predisposition. But cervical cancer per se is related to the age at coitus. So earlier the age of coitus, the higher the chances of cervical cancer, number of
Okay.
sexual partners, the kind of vaginal infections you could be suffering from. If you've not been doing an annual pap smear, so a pap smear is mandatory for any girl who's been se sexually active for more than a year and has to be doing it annually and not once in 3 years.
Okay.
Taking the cervical cancer vaccine, avoiding smoking, and of course, keeping your general health intact. We do know, we've learned in the pandemic that it's the survival of the fittest. It's a Charles Darwin's theory, which is coming out to be turning out to be so true. So you have to work towards your fitness, and that's what is going to prevent you from cervical disease. If you're unsure about your partner, you should be using a condom to prevent any sort of vaginal or cervical infections.
Sure. Thank you so much for that. That was very interesting. Ma'am, I'm sure many patients have approached you regarding fertility treatments. So how would you describe the impact of health and lifestyle on fertility?
Okay, now again, regarding fertility, my dear, what we've seen is a shift of the age for planning babies right from the 20s and pushing it to the 30s. Why? Because girls are finding their partners late. One, second, they're not financially stabilized, so they want to take time to get pregnant. But understand that a girl has a limited obstetric scope, wherein a man can repopulate the world at the age of 90. A girl's eggs start to age after the age of 30, more so after 32, even more after 35, and the chances of chromosomal defects, abnormal babies also starts to happen after 35. So what I usually recommend is to plan at least one child if you find your pa found your partner before the age of 30, and in the early 30s, the other child. So it's extremely important to try and see that you're physically fit to be pregnant. So any pregnancy now we say cannot happen as an accident. So you need to go for a pre-pregnancy counseling. Whether you have anemia, you need to check for thalassemia. If there's any history of Down syndrome or any chromosomal defects in the family, if there's been a history of consanguinity where you're getting married to a first cousin, it happens in a few communities wherein there could be a possibility of having genetic defects. So these patients need to be investigated further in order to see that there is not going to be any genetic malformation in the baby. Also, ruling out any medical problems. So, whether you're basically a patient with heart disease, which has been unnoticed, or whether you have a case of asthma, or you have any chronic renal disease. So, we do have patients with these problems as well, but they need super medical supervision, and we do take care. So, that's called high risk obstetrics, wherein we take care of them, or there could be diabetics who are getting pregnant. So, we need to take care of all of these.
Understood. Ma'am, when I was researching about you, I realized that you're pursuing robotics as a field alongside laparoscopy. So what led you to do that, ma'am? That's very interesting. I mean, I haven't heard of many surgeons who like specialize in robotics as a field in particular, at least in India. So what led you to do that?
So let me take you through my journey in Wadia Hospital years ago. That is in the year 1990 and 91. I was appointed as a family planning officer, and that is where we were doing tubal ligations laparoscopically, sterilizations laparoscopically, and that's what kind of cultivated my interest into minimal access surgery, and that's laparoscopic surgery. And from there on, I started to develop my skills and nurture my skills. And then later, with super specialization in laparoscopy, I started to do this very easily from the year 2000 in all the possible hospitals that I was employed in. And then I said, what is further on, and what is the best, or what is something that is going to be the highest possible training that I can gain in minimal access surgery? And that was robotics. So that's when I had a French mentor who taught me. And it was amazing to see how you can actually dock in the robot and do the laparoscopic or the robotic surgery. But honestly, now with the cost of the Da Vinci robot that we use, it's kind of overbearing because it costs 1,10,000 each time you use the robot. So we currently are relying on our hands and waiting for the technology to get a little cheaper. But of course, in patients who require that precision of a 3D image, the ease of suturing, like advanced malignancies, I think robotics really means a lot. The reason I chose endoscopic surgery or minimal access surgery is because of the comfort that it offers a patient, because mm-hmm. there is less pain, lesser or a shorter hospital stay. A patient is up and about, walking around within hours of the surgery, less morbidity. Patient gets back on her toes and gets back to work very soon. Women, you know, are the backbone in the family, so they can't be lying down with a large cut on the abdomen, wherein you can actually kind of sort out their problems through minimal access. So I think that's something that is really very gratifying when you want to see your patients up and about within hours and sorting out their problems. So that Definitely. Is what really lured me towards endoscopy. Yes.
Okay, so going a little further behind in your journey, what led you to become a doctor to begin with?
Well, I belong to a family of doctors. So my father was a very eminent ENT surgeon. My mother was a doctor as well. And then I have siblings who are also doctors. So I breathe medicine. I live medicine. And I'm married to a doctor.
Oh my God.
That's how it goes. Yes.
Okay.
And I always had a passion. And believe me, even when I started to babble, I knew I had to become a doctor, because that was probably what I was seeing all around. And once I was in my 10th standard and, you know, looking into my pre-med training, I knew that I wanted to be a gynecologist, because I had that kind of inclination and a passion towards gynecology. And there I am.
Congratulations, ma'am. It's really inspiring.
Thank you.
Yes.
So thank you.
What was your most interesting case as a surgeon?
Well, you can't just put your finger on one particular case, my dear, because there are so many. But recently we had a very interesting case. This young girl who was not yet had children was flown in with a large cyst, and this cyst almost had 11 liters of fluid in it, and from the ovary. And it was almost looking like a gravid uterus. So when the patient came in for examination, my nurse runs in and gets a Doppler, thinking it's a pregnant patient. And I said, no, sister, this is not a pregnant patient. So this patient actually, during the lockdown, thought that she was putting on weight because of lack of going to the gym. And when she went with some physical discomfort and went for a sonography, they found that there was this huge cyst arriving from the ovary, which was almost overriding the liver. So the point of concern was when they came to me and they said, doc, we've been told by different people that there could be a cancer and we need to open up the abdomen. I said, no, we have certain specialized investigations which we can see and decide on the mode of treatment. We do know that there is hardly a place for laparoscopy in advanced ovarian cancers. So I said, first, let's do all our tests to see that this lesion is benign, because they really couldn't tell me when the onset of the problem could have been, since she was in Bangalore. So there are tests that we can do, like blood tests, wherein there are tumor markers like a CA125, the ROMA mm-hmm. index, the HE4, and getting imaging done with an MRI, which gives you an almost a clear precision whether you are dealing with a benign or a malignant problem. So luckily, all her problems turned to be benign. And what we did is we took her into the theater. We ultrasound guidance drained this entire fluid. We drained about 11 liters of fluid from her ovary till we got it into the pelvis, and then removed the cyst, not compromising on any part of the ovary, because she yet has to prove her fertility and her obstetric career. And believe me, she was home in about 72 hours and on her toes and walking within 18 hours. So that's the beauty, with just 3 keyholes, having handled her problem.
That's really
so that's
inspiring.
Very gratifying. Of that's course. Very gratifying. But there are challenges. I think each index case teaches you something new. So you can't really put your finger on one particular case and say that, oh, this has been the best or this has been the most tough one. Each case is a challenge. So you never know when you're entering what you're going to see. But you have to have the capacity, the ability to be very precise and take instant decisions, which would be the best for the patient.
So, ma'am, I read that you had started a 200, like you had commissioned a 200 bed hospital in Aurangabad in memory of your father, which is really inspiring mm-hmm. and, you know, really wholesome to hear about. So have you engaged in any other social service activities? And why do you think it's so important that you know, people engaged in social service in general?
My father, being a very eminent surgeon in my hometown, Aurangabad, this particular venture was something that my family decided on. And luckily, because now I'm in Mumbai, it's being handled by my family out there. So I'm not part of it right now. But of course, if and whenever they need my support, I would definitely be there for it. But of course, I pursue a lot of my social services over here. So there's a night school that we cater to for the last 17 years, wherein we supply them with books. And these are actually children who are underprivileged. We say there shouldn't be child labor, but you'd be surprised that these kids are working on trains. They're working in Dharavi in small units, wherein they're sticking gums on bindis, or they're working in certain costume shops, you know, wherein they're doing certain embroidery and stuff. And they have this desire to study. And that's when they come to the night schools. And we actually take care of them by supporting them with whatever books they require, guides. I also give them nutrition supplements in the form of iron and calcium. I do not really believe in giving financial support directly in the form of money in any organization's hand, because I feel it doesn't really reach to the end point. So I think it's best to give books, it's best to give medicines, it's best to give food. I arrange some picnics for them wherever possible. And I, of course, give them very encouraging talks whenever I can. Any child who I feel is talented, like there could be somebody who's good at painting or singing. Luckily, by virtue of my profession, I do know people who are singers or directors or art directors, or there are people who arrange exhibitions like Priyadat. So for art. So that's when I request them to kind of give them an opportunity to kind of, portray their art. And we give these kids that kind of a push and give them that sort of encouragement. And that really is very gratifying.
Yeah, of course. That's very inspiring work, ma'am. Thank you. And I just have one last question before we end this talk. What words of wisdom would you like to share with listeners belonging to a younger generation who aspire to be doctors?
Well, medicine, my dear kids, is something that is extremely tedious as a profession. You need to be very focused. You need to be putting in a lot of hard work, not just get taken in by the glamour of being a doctor, because by the time we have reached these big corporate hospitals, let me tell you, we have worked in all the possible municipal hospitals, like a Kurla Bhaba, like a Cooper Hospital, Wadia Hospital, where we've actually trained hands-on on patients. And that is what each patient that you touch is going to be increasing your experience. So this is all about touch with a patient, compassion, and a lot of dedication. So you need to be there. You need to be always be there and focused, and understand that technology is there to guide you, but it's an adjunct to your clinical diagnosis. It's very simple, you know, when I hold my patient's hand, the patient may just feel I'm saying a hello. But when I hold her hand, I know whether her hand is cold or clammy, whether her skin is dry. So if it's cold and clammy, I know it could be a sign of nervousness. If it's dry, I know there could be thyroid issues. When I feel her pulse, if the pulse is riding high, I could feel that it's probably a patient with borderline hypertension. So there's so much that you can gather when you actually touch and feel a patient, and that's what is required in this profession. You know, it's so funny. My daughter at times tells me, when I was sitting at the airport, sometimes I say, oh, she could probably be a hypothyroid. She could be probably a diabetic. And she says, Mom, are you crazy? But that's what happens when you've actually touched or seen thousands of patients. You exactly can make out, looking at them, oh, she could be probably having these particular maladies. So that's what comes with experience. And that's where you have to be there, dedicated in that profession, wanting to serve humanity. And if you have that within you, only then choose the profession. Otherwise, it's not really worth it.
Thank you so much for this, ma'am. It's been really inspiring. And thank you for your amazing work to society in general. It's really commendable. So thank you so much, ma'am.
Thank you again for having me here. And I wish everybody good health. And let me tell you, please work towards your health. So daily exercise, daily yoga. Remember, Shamak Dawar is a very good friend of mine. And he says, Ranjana, like, you need to sleep, you need to eat, you need to exercise because you need to detox your body. And we do know that this pandemic has taught us the importance of fitness. So I leave you all with a word on fitness, that keep yourselves healthy and safe, and God bless you all. Thank you.